Welcome to the Real Estate and More Show. I'm Michael Hatfield, your host. Today, we're going to talk about people who give to others, people that actually donate their time or people who donate their money. The way that they do it to help others in this world is just amazing. So today, we're honored to have Michael in our studio. Michael is a general contractor by trade. He's worked all over for money.
But in his personal life, he's chosen a different life policy.
Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's definitely our pleasure. Now, you've worked for a number of organizations in helping people. You've donated your skills and your time. And the one that comes to mind firstly is the tsunami and donating to the people of Japan. Just after the tsunami, I believe you left for how many months?
I was in Japan for 3 months.
And what urged you to go?
You know, I don't know if I could say that there was any one specific thing that urged me to go. It was one of those moments in life where the path just sort of opened in front of me, and I was issued or ushered forward. I worked with Samaritan's Purse for 3 months in Kesenuma and a couple other small fishing towns north of Tokyo.
How did you find out about Samaritan's Purse? That's a GRAM organization, a well-thought-of charitable organization that's boots on the ground when these disasters happen. How did you find out about them?
Actually, it was at a family function, and my Aunt Pat mentioned the organization to me one night. I don't remember if it was a Christmas or an Easter or a birthday, but she mentioned it. I wrote it down on a piece of paper, and I threw it on my table where it sat for probably a year, and then I was going through notes that I had, and I saw it, and it, I don't remember what month that was exactly. It was 2011, probably approximately August, and I found the note, and I went online and looked at the Samaritan's Purse website, and it was following the tsunami, which I think was in 2009 at the end. And they were still actively looking for people to go to Japan and work in reconstructing homes and sometimes businesses. So I filled out the forms, and they responded to me, and I ended up over there within probably about 3 weeks.
So you went over there, you kind of put everything on hold on your life here on the mainland, and picked up stakes and went over there to do exactly what?
Well, I'm a hands-on person, so I work with my hands to do whatever needs to be done. When I got there, it became apparent fairly quickly that I was one of the more knowledgeable people in construction. The Japanese, in the areas that we were working in, they had slightly different construction practices, but you know, the gross principles are all largely the same. And so I ended up in a minor leadership role teaching people. There were folks working with Samaritan's Purse from all over the world, from Canada, from Germany, from America, all over America. I think there might have even been a few people from Africa. But yeah, so I ended up taking people that knew something and they were willing and able, and I would teach them whatever I could and help them to see the project happen, whatever it was. We did probably a couple dozen homes, and then there was a language school. There was one business. I forget exactly what the business was, but they had already been mucked out, so other volunteers had come through earlier, and they had shoveled out all of the mud and the debris and, you know, ripped all the drywall and wall coverings off and gotten rid of all of the items that were disposable and had been soaked out and had mold or any kind of contamination. And so the places were taken down typically to studs, and then maybe there was structural damage, maybe there wasn't. We would start there, fix that, and then start putting them all back together all the way through finish for, once again, whatever the structure was, whether it was a home or a business or a school.
Primarily, people didn't have a place to go. You saw it in their eyes as you worked on their homes, I would imagine.
When I landed in Japan, it had largely been cleaned up in the sense that they had run tractors through most of the towns and they had cleared the main debris. A lot of people were still living in tent cities or temporary Quonset hut type structures, barracks. We lived in like a barracks environment until we moved into another building that was given to us, and we finished that out, and that became a base of operations. But yeah, the people, it ran the spectrum. I think primarily at the time that I was there, the people that were still in the area and trying to get back into their homes and rebuild their homes, they were living in tents, and then we would, if their structure was still standing sufficiently, we would put everything back together, and then they would be able to move back into it.
You know, at the same time, there were some real issues with the nuclear reactors at the time. Did the crew that you worked with have any concern about the long-term effects of that, or was it that the purpose of the mission was so important to helping others that you minimize those concerns?
You know, I don't remember it being much of a point of discussion among us. It was something we might joke about here and there. I don't recall exactly the numbers of contamination or the distance we were from it. I would have to look at a map and try and remember all of the details on that. But my mentality personally and the mentality of the people that I was with was largely, you know, I was working with Samaritan's Purse and we're a Christian organization. And so I think we all felt like we needed to be there. We had the opportunity to participate in the world around us in a positive way. And whatever risk we might be taking from that was irrelevant.
So in other words, you left the work that you were doing, that you were meaning and gainfully employed, and you went to receive very little in exchange for helping others because you were driven to do so. Is that not correct?
Yeah. The times that I have been given the opportunity to work in reconstructing things, whether it was after Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico or the tsunami in Japan or floods in Indiana and other places in America, or whenever those opportunities have come unfurled before me, I felt very much like there just wasn't really any other thing to think about.
Well done. Well done. In Gary, Indiana, you mentioned that's here, right here on the mainland United States. What was the issue there? You said there were floods.
Those were floods. I don't even remember what year that was. That was prior to Japan. So maybe it was, I think Japan might have actually been 2010. The end of 2010, turning over to 2011. I came home in 2011. But in Gary, Indiana, I worked with another organization called World Renew. And they're essentially the Dutch Reformed Church out of Minnesota or Wisconsin, I forget. And one of the individuals that I worked with in Indiana and Illinois, we were right on the border. His name was Doug Cooperus, and he was from Canada. I don't remember which part of Canada, the cold part. And he was probably about 80 years old and a very striking Canadian personality in the pace he spoke and the way that he worked and the way that he thought about everything. And it was one of those moments in Japan that was a really, I would say it was powerful and fascinating and interesting. They were moving me from the first base that I was at up to the second base, which was the one that needed to be built. And when the folks realized that I could do the electrical and I could do the plumbing and the more technical infrastructure, they sent me up there to try and get this new base in Kesanuma completed on a faster pace. And I walked in and I was being given a tour by the base manager. I think it was Buzz at the time. And I heard this voice from across the room in a large common area that became our cafeteria. And he was just kind of going along at the pace that he was going. I don't even remember what he was talking about. But I heard this and I was like, I know that voice. But I was in such a foreign place that I'd never been to. And I had never spoken to any of these people. And everything was so unfamiliar. It kind of made my brain skip a beat. But Yeah, he was another a fellow that I had worked with in a totally different time and place.
Gary, Indiana.
Yeah, a year or two before.
Oh, fantastic. So Gary, Indiana had floods. It was prior to the disaster in Japan. It seems like the people rise out of desperation at some point, out of sadness and out of despair, and move into a sense of community. And what I believe you're describing as your driving force to do all this is being part of the community that's really doing something for people. And I sense that in what you say and as you talk. Real briefly, Gary, Indiana, floods?
Yes, there were floods. I don't remember the name of the floods or the storm that brought them. It's been too many years.
And what happened was the result?
Yeah, they flooded out a bunch of homes, and you know they had to be mucked out, and all the sheetrock torn off, at least on the first floors, and then we would repair, you know, all the finish after they were decontaminated.
Do you remember the most remarkable interaction with a resident of Gary, Indiana?
You know, Gary, Indiana, because it's been so much time between then and now, the only real striking one that I remember there was. And I can't even remember the family's name, but it was a family, a husband and wife, and I think they had five children. And the husband worked for the train authority, or the subway, whatever the term is out there. And the wife took care of the kids. And their bathroom, you know, the reconstruction typically happens at least 6 months after the disaster. You know, there's decontamination that has to happen just from the, whether it's sewage that gets mixed into the waters that flood things, or whether it's, you know, the water from putting out fires, or whether it's the chemicals that are created and released from fires. In many cases, there are bodies that are continuing to be found. There were still bodies being found in Japan when I was working there in our town. And so the reconstruction doesn't typically start immediately. There's like a triage thing that goes on where it's cleanup, it's getting people into temporary housing, getting their basic sanitary and you know, logistical life needs met. And then there's a period where everything kind of settles down. And then the people who are going to work in reconstruction come and they start actually putting things back together. So in Indiana, this family had been without a bathroom. I think they had like this one kind of rinky-dink halfway bathroom that they were sort of like taking sponge baths out of, and it had been 12 or 16 months since the floods. And as I said, it was five children, some of them very young, and a husband and a wife. And the husband would go to work, and the wife would try and deal with all of these things with, you know, several of their rooms in their home just torn down to studs. And I remember just talking to them and kind of being like, wow, this is how you're having to live, and you've had to live this way for a considerable period of time. I'm grateful to have the opportunity to help put this back together.
Oh, well said. Now, back on the tsunami, there was a family there that you mentioned at one point in our briefing that was very grateful to the workers. Back in Japan now.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, well, yes, it was a family, but there was one individual, her name was Hanjo-san, and she was a Japanese grandmother and aunt. And I don't know if I could estimate her age. I'm going to say she was at least 60, and she could have been as much as 80. Hard to tell for me personally, but she lost her nephew to the tsunami, and I think one or two other family members. And she, when I went to Japan, before I went, I was told, both by the people organizing with Samaritan's Purse, as well as Japanese friends that I had who came from Japan, not to expect much in the way of emotions being shared, not to expect much in the way of personal connection, because the Japanese culture, that's just something that takes years to get to. And I didn't take it too seriously. I didn't disregard it. I just kind of filed it away in my head. But I remember one day we were at Hanjo-san's home and we were rebuilding and we took lunch, and oftentimes she would insist that she feed us. We would come with bento boxes that had been packed for us by Samaritan's Purse cafeteria people volunteering in the cafeteria, but she would always insist on, at the very least, you know, we would take a 10 o'clock break or something and serve us tea and some kind of little snacks or crackers. But this time she was feeding us lunch and she was sitting down with us, and she spoke Japanese, not really hardly any English. She was speaking to Richard, who was our he was our interpreter, and he was sort of the most senior among us of that team on that project. And he was an American who had moved to Japan. He spoke Japanese. He was married to a Japanese woman. And Hanjo-san and Rich were talking to each other. And I was sitting there. They were speaking in Japanese. I didn't understand a word of it. But I was watching and just kind of sitting there open emotionally to the two of them and just observing. And she started telling Rich her story in Japanese, which at the time I didn't understand any of the details of, but her emotions started to come out. And it was a moment where I felt so connected to her. I could feel her grief, even though I didn't understand any of the words she was saying, just because of the way that it was rolling out of her, I don't know, like waves across the ocean or something. And it was a powerful moment. It was one of the first times in my life where I felt so connected to a stranger or so vulnerable in somebody else's experience. And
the resonance.
Yeah.
The resonance of another human being that you've been able to help. And that.
Yeah. And I will say that there was a certain element of pride to be able to participate in that, and the fact that she was able to share that with us and that we were able to potentially help heal it in some way.
Mm. Very well done. Puerto Rico. You served in Puerto Rico. What organization was that?
Puerto Rico was Hurricane Maria, and that was, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago. And that was once again with World Renew, the Dutch Reformed Church out of, I think it's Minnesota, it might be Wisconsin. Yeah, the Hurricane Maria came through and it completely ripped off a whole bunch of roofs, and people were living in homes that were raining inside whenever the storms came through. Mm-hmm. And so I did a whole bunch of roofs there, and we did some more finished items inside. You know, we worked on structures in Puerto Rico that were little more than a bunch of pallets screwed together with some corrugated steel over the top of them to keep the rain out. I mean, they weren't really homes, if it was something that gave a person a place to live out of the sun and out of the rain, then, you know, when we left it was still better than when we got there.
Mm. So what drew you to go to Puerto Rico? Same thing? Same feeling? Same desire to help?
It's something that every single time I've had the opportunity to go contribute, I've discovered that it's the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And so I go there and I contribute and I come back better than I was before and with a greater understanding. And there's never been a case where it took something away from me. Every single time I've tried to give, it has given back to me more than I put out.
Mm, well done. People in Puerto Rico, is there another person or family that you recall that expressed gratitude that touched your heart?
There was one individual. He was a man and he lived alone. And I think he was probably about 50 or 60 years old. And he was one of the least finished structures that I worked on when I was there. I don't remember his name now even. We worked on his house for probably 4 days, and I rebuilt the roof structure and put new finished roofing on. But, you know, it was hot in Puerto Rico, hot and humid, and we were working outside primarily, and this fellow was walking around basically without a shirt, and he was a little bit infirm, and on his chest he had a big old zipper from a heart surgery. And so I also had a heart surgery when I was younger, And it just became a point of conversation. I don't remember who was even interpreting for us because he didn't speak English and my Spanish is pretty poor. But we kind of talked about our experiences and, you know, he was one of those people where he had no other option. If we didn't put the roof on his house and fix his, you know, not to be disrespectful, but it was a shanty. If we didn't fix this space for him, he was going to be living in the rain in a couple months when it started up again. Or, you know, even then it was raining, but it was warm, so it didn't matter as much. But, it, you know, we were the only option for him.
And what did he say when you were done? Did he interpret through somebody to tell you his gratitude?
Yeah, I mean, we basically shared the emotion and, you know, both of us having had similar surgeries and experiences, there's a heart connection that, you know, you can share tears. It wasn't my house that got torn up, but I can share the grief of the loss. I don't remember if he had lost anybody. He was really kind of alone in life. As I recall.
Looking at your biography, you've been donating your time and working with the people of City Team Ministries. Can you tell us about City Team Ministries and what they actually do and what you've done over the last 13 years with them?
The City Team is, since it's been such an ongoing relationship and since City Team's needs were so great over those period of time at different moments, depending. City Team is a recovery program, and they help people to get off the streets, to pull their lives back together. In some cases, folks are court ordered. In other cases, folks check themselves in. Everybody that's there chose City Team for one reason or another, even though they may have been in a situation where they had to choose one or the other. But City Team is pretty much the only place that I'm aware of that has any kind of significant success rate in helping people reconfigure their lives so that they can become productive, contributing members of society from a place of destitution, addiction, or you know, any kind of disruption. They actually take folks who have been on the street, and there are many men over there that I've spoken to, and you know, they were either in jail or they were living under a freeway overpass, shooting up or drinking or whatever their demon happened to be. And those guys have been clean for 6 months, a year, and many of them have been around for many years, and they become part of the program that helps the other men. I have a passing knowledge of many of the state, county, and city sponsored programs to help people, you know, ostensibly in the same way. And as far as I can tell, City Team's the only one who makes real inroads. It's a different place. The program, the men's program that I've primarily worked with is on Washington Street there by the police station in Oakland. And it's a four-story building with a basement that was built in 1882. And 13, 15 years ago, the thing was, you know, on its way to falling down. And they've worked really hard. They've had some changes in personnel in the management. Angela, she was a director of the Oakland location for the last 5 or 8 years. I'm not sure exactly. And, you know, she's really, the whole place is very different now than it was back then. But even back then, they were doing a pretty good job of helping people.
They've done such a wonderful job in Oakland, and they're not just Oakland, they're all around. They have done such a wonderful job with people right here on American soil, wouldn't you say?
I don't know the exact numbers of recidivism for the different organizations in the Bay Area, but my observation on a personal level is that City Team has changed lives in a very real and meaningful way. Women's program in Oakland, as well as their men's program in Oakland, and they have other programs. Their corporate headquarters are in San Jose. The men's program in Oakland runs a recovery program where the men live in the building, go through recovery, and then they have a segue back into society as they're able to get and hold down work. The City Team men's program in Oakland also serves the community with a food pantry. They pass out food to folks that need it. So there's always, you know, essentially a soup kitchen. If people don't have construction skills or other things to contribute, then you can work with just the daily outreach. Yeah, there's always a need for money, hands, and, you know, people who really have love to share.
It takes a lot to earn money to gift to others. It takes a lot to be able to get out and to use your hands to help people rebuild from devastation, from times that have been so heart-wrenching. People of Lahaina, Maui have recently experienced the deadliest inferno our nation has seen in more than 100 years. Many were lost, and those who remain desperately need help. To help these victims, you can give to convoyofhope.org/Maui or samaritanspurse.org/USDR. If you'd like to give to City Team Ministries, either being part of the operation or by giving, the telephone number is 888-248-9832. Let's make a difference. My guest today has been our son, Michael Hatfield II. He has went out into the world, all over the world, to help people, to give to others. May we all take a lesson from his example. You've been listening to Real Estate and More, although the more is probably more of what this show is all about. More means all else that has to do with life. Topics of the day, and interesting people. I'm your host, Michael Hatfield. Tune in next Saturday morning at 9 and have a most wonderful
week. Views and opinions
week.
Expressed are based on current economic and market conditions and are subject to change. Information on the show provided for illustrator purposes only and does not constitute professional or legal advice. Information from sources deemed reliable, but accuracy and completeness not guaranteed. Michael Hatfield and the Michael Hatfield REMAX team have no liability for information discussed on the show. Consult with qualified professionals prior to taking action.
We at the Michael Hatfield REMAX team enjoy representing our valued clients. If you or someone you know is interested in buying or selling and wishes to schedule a complimentary appointment with the Michael Hatfield REMAX team, call us at 925-322-7775. That's 925-322-7775. Or go to our website, michaelhatfieldhomes.com.
I'm Michael Hatfield. Thank you for listening today. Join us next Saturday for the next Real Estate and More, when we again sharpen our focus on how's the market.
Join us next Saturday and have a wonderful week. Best wishes and blessings to you. DRE 0149-3761.